Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host, and we got a little crossed up leaving the show yesterday. Didn't leave ourselves a lot of time, and I said there'll be a special guest here today. Well, our special guest is here with us, and our special guest is a very special person here at Catholic Answers, but also all around the Catholic world. Patrick Madrid is our guest. Hello, Patrick.
Cy Killett, good to be back in the same room with you.
It's so nice to have you here.
And thank you.
And everyone's excited that you're here and had lunch with us and hanging out. And
tacos.
Yeah, well, we know, Patrick. Yeah.
No, but that's what you had on hand.
Yeah, I know, but
thank
it's not
you.
Tuesday. Because you are quite famous for Taco Tuesday.
Every day is Taco Tuesday.
For those of you, for the 11 people listening who don't know Patrick Madrid, he's the host of the Patrick Madrid Show on the Relevant Radio Network in the mornings, but also the author of a whole bunch of books, Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years, How to Do Apologetics. But I think, are the most famous ones the Surprised by Truth ones? Is that the?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think because
the
first one came out in 94, so it would be the one that has been around longest.
So Wikipedia says, and I believe almost everything on Wikipedia, more than 1 million copies of your book sold worldwide.
Of the book's total. Not that one book, but the book's total.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thank you.
That's pretty good. Still traveling around, still doing apologetics and speaking all over the place.
Yeah. In fact, I've reflected on that recently. So I've done that for about 35 years now, almost incessantly. So it's been a big part of the work that I've done, of course, radio for the last, you know, umpteen years. But yeah, doing a lot of public speaking.
The number is 888-318-7884. If you'd like to talk with Patrick, you can ask anything you'd like. It's an open forum. Just call and ask whatever you like. 888-318-7884. Now, you are one of the first two or three people who worked here at Catholic Answers, Patrick.
Well, let's see, counting Carl, he was the very first.
So, right.
So Carl was the very first. Then there was a gentleman, may he rest in peace, Charlie Harvey, who was hired on, this must have been end of 87 or January of 88. And right around that time is when I hired on. So at first, it was just the three of us. And that didn't last long because we had all kinds of things going on. So Carl hired other people to do different jobs. But I was, I think, technically, not counting Carl, I think I was the second employee.
Wow. And really, it was a revolution at that time. It's not like today where there are quite a few good, and maybe there's some bad ones too, but there's a lot of good Catholic apologetics associations, podcasts, you know, individuals who are in it. But that wasn't the case when you guys started this.
That's true. Yeah, there was virtually nothing to speak of. Of course, there was no internet in those days, but there were no conferences, there were no books, there were no resources other than things that had been written many years earlier. So like radio replies from the 1920s and 30s, that was available. But many people didn't know about those resources. And so this was a time in the 80s when a lot of Catholics were under stress because they were getting challenged by Protestant folk, but they didn't know where to turn for answers. So it was really a providential thing that Catholic Answers began when it did.
Again, the number 888-318-7884. Patrick Madrid, our guest, one of the originals here at Catholic Answers, and really one of the people who was part of the energy behind what really is a whole new movement of apologetics.
You know, I'd like to talk, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about that for a moment, Cy, and that is that I think of myself, at least the time when I was at Catholic Answers for 8 years, as the guy who was helping to pour the cement for the foundation.
Okay.
Because all the real, and I mean this sincerely, all the really significant things that happened after my time. So radio happened after my time. Publishing, it kind of had gotten started a little bit, but not by much. But it really took off. The pilgrimages and all the website and all those things all happened after I was with Catholic Answers. So I really have a fondness for my time at Catholic Answers because I felt like at least I got a chance to pour the foundation.
Right.
And everything else was able to build on that.
Yeah, yeah. And what was it? My sense is that there was a period there where as beautiful as the ecumenical movement is, that ecumenism was almost considered apologetics or defending the Catholic faith to be, something we didn't want to do. That would get in the way. Did you have that sense in those days? And then you had to kind of relearn the the church's habit of defending her teachings?
I didn't, but I ran into it a lot. Maybe that's what you're driving at. So yeah. I do remember hearing from priests back in the 1980s when I was just getting started. And Carl had been doing this work for some years, I mean, probably 6, 7, 8 years at least, part-time. And he was doing it when he wasn't lawyering, which was his primary occupation. Right. But I had not done any of it in that way before I started at Catholic Answers. But when I started in conversation with many Catholic priests who would say, you know, we're so glad to see this because in the seminary they told us that apologetics is bad and it's anti-ecumenical and it's Vatican II, yeah. Pre-Vatican II rather. So there definitely was a mindset that many people had that Catholic Answers was retrograde and was not ecumenical. And these things weren't true, but it took a lot of effort on the part of the apostolate to try to help them see that apologetics, when it's done properly, with respect and charity and patience, that it can be at the service of ecumenism.
Yeah. Again, there's just one line open now. The number is 888-318-7884. The great Patrick Madrid here with us. Answer any question that you've got. That's a pretty good deal when you get Patrick Madrid in the studio with you. So, Patrick, a lot of phone calls. You want to take some questions?
Okay, let's do it.
Joseph in St. Louis, Missouri, watching on Catholic.com. We're glad to have you, Joseph. Go ahead with your question for Patrick.
All right. Yeah, well, thanks, Cy, for having me on. Patrick, I love your show. I listened to it earlier today. I think you're a great guy.
Thank you.
So I'll cut straight to the quick. So my question is this, and there's a reason I want to ask it, but I'll start with the question. Has the church ever taught geocentrism as a definitive or non-definitive teaching? Now, but before you answer, real quick, the reason I ask is because in a letter that Cardinal Bellarmine, I was reading a book, and in a letter that Cardinal Bellarmine wrote to Father Foscarini, an Italian priest, I think it was in 1616 when Galileo first got in trouble, about biblical interpretation, he seemed to expand what the church means by matters of faith and morals to incorporate natural phenomena. And I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on that. And I have the quote, if you want it, but.
Well, sure. If you wanted to quote it, that's fine with me. But I would say, number one, I'm not familiar with that quote, so I don't know from having read it or studied it what was said. Not that I doubt the point that you're making. But the definitive outline of the parameters of, if you're implying something having to do with infallibility, and you may not be, but if you are, those parameters were defined by the First Vatican Council in 1870, and science is not part of the area that is described there in Pastor Eternus as the province within which falls the Pope's teaching office. Now, if you're referring to the broader magisterium, it doesn't refer to that there only because it's dealing with the infallibility of the Pope in that particular council. But regardless, I think we could safely say, at least to the limited extent that I have any knowledge about the geocentrism controversy, and I don't have much knowledge about it, but certainly by the time Galileo was making his scientific discoveries, he was not getting into trouble because of heliocentrism. And heliocentrism, as an alternative theory, had been well known for a long time. I think even Ptolemy, millennia ago, knew about it and wrote about it. But what got Galileo into trouble was not the science itself, but because he was purporting to support the science using Scripture. He was purporting to interpret Scripture in a way other than the Church traditionally did, and it wasn't his province as a scientist to do so. So since you mentioned Galileo in passing, I'll just reference that because I don't think even then that it was so much geocentrism that was the problem for him as it was him usurping this magisterial area of Scripture that wasn't something that he had competence to do. Now, maybe there's more to your question, but if there is, let me know.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think that's... so with geocentrism, In a couple talks I listened to by Christopher Check, he mentioned that it's not that geocentrism, and neither was heliocentrism, a doctrine or even an infallible teaching. It wasn't any of that. Mm-hmm. It was really a pronouncement by the Inquisition, I think, which was a juridical body, but it wasn't. But it wasn't the magisterium teaching that. I guess would that interpretation of things like Joshua, where it says the sun stands still, mm-hmm. Or some of the Psalms, where it seems to support geocentrism, mm-hmm. would that be like a non-definitive teaching that could be wrong? Or
well, let's be careful here. I certainly do not hold that Scripture in any way teaches error. So we could roll that out if that's one of the possibilities. I would say that those phenomena were real. They really did happen. And so as far as I'm concerned, the phenomenological approach to passages like that, which simply means that it is the language of appearance, and it appeared to everybody who was there when this battle took place that the sun stopped so that more daylight could be given so that the Israelites could win the battle. And it would be a true statement that as far as they could see from what they could tell, it looked to them like the sun had stopped. And I would compare that, and I know we don't have endless time, Si, so I don't want to endlessly go on, but think of it in terms of the miracle at Fatima in October of 1917, where we know that the sun did not move from its place in the heavens and come toward the earth. But from the standpoint of the people who were there in Fatima, 70,000 or more people, it appeared to them that that's what happened. And the two are not mutually exclusive. It doesn't necessarily have to be a scientific fact that that heavenly body moved, but it could have been miraculous insofar as it was made to appear that way for the people who were there. So I draw a comparison between the miracle of the sun at Fatima and the passage in Joshua where the sun appeared to stand still. But I'm not an expert on such topics. I'll have to leave it to those who are. But those are a few thoughts of my own.
Joseph, I got to say thank you because we got to take our first break. Patrick Madrid is our guest. It's open forum. Ask whatever you like. 888-318-7884.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
The most original Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
What have you always wanted to know about the Vatican? Well, I'm your Vatican Insider, and I answer that question when I bring you the news about the Pope, Vatican City, and I share insights and stories from a broad spectrum of church ministries.
Vatican Insider with Joan Lewis, Saturday night, 9 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Si Kellett, your host in studio with Patrick Madrid. Of course, the editor of the Surprised by Truth books and the author of a whole bunch of books and one of America's great apologists. And I always liked that other book that you did where you did the two Surprised by Truth books. I think it's two. But then surprised
four.
By... Oh, it's four.
It's four now.
Oh my gosh. I'm behind in my reading, Patrick. Sorry.
Get to it.
But the Surprised by Life one. Is the one that
that's
I like.
That's the fourth.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, because that is, that's people who came to the Catholic Church because the Catholic Church is pro-life.
Yeah, that has a big part to play. These are people who did not find their way to the church through Bible verses or historical data. It was through abortion and sexual promiscuity and drug use and divorce and just insanity, just really insane situations that these people went through. And it was in the midst of those things that the Lord found them.
Yeah,
and brought them into the church. It's really an amazing compilation of stories.
But I also like it because I do think sometimes we have to refute the idea that, oh, the church is driving people away with its sexual teachings or its teachings on life. No, It's not.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Yeah.
If you understand them, I think people are drawn to the truth, obviously.
Let's go to Lloyd in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Lloyd, thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with your question for Patrick Madrid.
Hello, hello there. Hi, Pat. It's been a long time.
Is this Lloyd Ringrose?
That's he.
Wow.
Hi, sir.
Wow. Talk about a blast from the past. How are you, Lloyd?
Oh, I'm hanging in there. I'm hanging in there. I've been wanting to talk to you for years, but I didn't know how to get in touch with you.
So well, here he is.
On the show today. Mm-hmm. Well, Cy, Patrick and I actually had a debate back in around 1992 or 3. I was an evangelical back then.
Wow. So,
and I returned to the church around 2007.
Beautiful.
And, long story, but... I was like, yeah, I'd love to talk to Pat Madrid sometime. And I had no idea how to get a hold of you, Pat. So I'm glad you're on the air today.
Well, thank you. If you ever want to reach me on Twitter, I'm active on Twitter. My address on Twitter is @PatrickMadrid, and my website is patrickmadrid.com, so I'm easy to find. But if you really want the full dose, I'm on every morning on Relevant Radio, so you'll find the Patrick Madrid show there.
When Patrick says he's on Twitter, too, or active on Twitter, that doesn't quite capture the full presence of Patrick Madrid on Twitter. You're probably about the most active Catholic voice on Twitter.
I don't know about that.
I don't see anybody that's doing well. I don't know, but I'm very impressed with it. Let me just say thank you. Yeah.
Well, I did open a Twitter account not too long ago after Elon Musk talked about buying Twitter. I thought, you know what? I think I'm going to set up a Twitter account, so I'll look for you on Twitter.
Yeah. Thanks, Lloyd. You know, I remember that it was at the New Wine Christian Fellowship in Sunnymead, California, or something like that.
Yeah, Moreno Valley.
And I do remember at one point during the break, it occurred to me to mention that the pastor of the New Wine Christian Fellowship had left, he had broken away from a Protestant church in Riverside. And I remember saying that, what's to prevent somebody from breaking away from this church and forming the newer New Wine Christian Fellowship if they didn't agree with what the pastor was saying there? And I remember in our debate, you and I, what were we talking about that? Was it Sola Scriptura that night, or what was our debate topic?
Yeah, we were basically debating Sola Scriptura.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I was bringing up the point about how even it sounds nice, Sola Scriptura looks good on paper, but it doesn't lead to unity. It leads to fragmentation and division, sadly. And that was an amazing debate. And by the way, if I've never said welcome home to the Catholic Church, let me say it now. It's really great that you came back.
Thank you, Pat. Yeah, that was quite a debate. It turned into a real circus, didn't it?
I have good memories of it.
Well, Lloyd, thank you.
Thank you, Lloyd.
I'm so grateful for that call, and what a beautiful witness. And it must be satisfying after 35 years in this business to have old friends of that were adversaries at one time of a sort.
Yeah, that's true. And I didn't really know Lloyd, and I don't remember that we really stayed much in touch after that debate. I don't remember who set it up or how. But anyway, it was a cordial debate, a gentlemanly debate. But often over the years, I've been asked, of the people that you've debated, have any of them ever become Catholic? And the one person I knew of who had was Lloyd. Yeah, so I was happy to be able to say, well, at least one person.
Thanks, Lloyd. Thanks again. I'm going to move now to, we'll stay here in California, in Nipomo, California. Steve, watching on YouTube. Steve, go ahead with your question for Patrick Madrid.
Yes, hello, gentlemen. I, too, was attracted to the Catholic Church because of her teaching on sexual ethics and abortion. My question pertains to a scenario of a wife and a husband who leaves her amoris laetitia and goes with the woman and then says to the pastor, the father, that I'm no longer going to have, fornicate with her and... presents himself for the Eucharist, but where does that leave the wife that he's left? I don't. Am I missing something, or
is this a divorce and remarriage question?
It's an example given in the Amoris Laetitia of as much as I've read. I'm not. I'm. I'm coming towards the Catholic Church because of its beauty and truth and adherence to that. Mm-hmm. And I just saw what I seen to be a contradiction. Where does that leave the wife, you know, divorced or non-divorced?
So, but she's been abandoned by the husband?
Yes, yes, sir.
Okay, and then can the husband go back to communion if he's abandoned her?
Yeah, he says he's no longer having sex with the girl he's living with.
Okay. And, yeah, that seems like.
I just wonder. I understand he can go back, but where does that leave the wife?
Right.
Is that
okay?
You know,
well, let's.
I don't. Maybe I'm just not understanding.
Fair enough. So let's begin there. So, not being a canon lawyer, but doing my best to be well acquainted with this topic, especially, I understand that the church's law it differentiates between the victim in a divorce, meaning the party who doesn't walk out of the marriage versus the person who does. So in this scenario, let's say the wife is victimized because her husband leaves her and leaves her family, her children, and then takes up with another woman. Well, he certainly has committed a grave sin, and to the extent that he's doing other, you know, shenanigans with another woman, that's another reason why he should not receive Holy Communion. But she herself, so long as she doesn't seek to get remarried and she's living according to her married status, she's not in any way prevented from receiving the sacraments. So the church makes a distinction between those two categories. And if that's the nature of your question, it doesn't leave her anywhere that she wasn't before. She's still able to go to confession in good faith, receive Holy Communion. Those things are still available to her because she hasn't done anything wrong.
But now, she has been wronged, though. I mean, husbands shouldn't abandon their wife.
No.
And I'm not sure if that's what Steve's asking, but...
I think. He said, where does it leave her?
Yeah,
so I'm wondering if maybe that's what he means
Steve,
by that.
Steve, did that get to what you wanted?
What he just said is what I was wondering. Where's the woman? Because does that compromise her? You know,
no.
It seems how it somehow could compromise her.
No. Well, I mean, it might compromise her financially and emotionally and in many other ways when her husband abandons her. But she's not done anything wrong. So in terms of her access to the sacraments, nothing has changed for her.
Thanks, Steve, very much for that question. And that is the case with divorce. Many times a divorced person is what we might call the victim of divorce, not the perpetrator of the divorce. But thanks again, Steve. I'm going to go to Oklahoma now. Brody in Oklahoma is listening to EWTN on Channel 130, Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Brody, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Hello, Brody. How old are you?
I'm 11.
Well, thank you very much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Madrid.
My question is, what is going to be different from heaven back in Adam and Eve with now? How are we not going to sin?
That's a good question, because it seems like how could Adam and Eve sin when they saw God and they had it made? The difference is that in heaven, you will have the beatific vision. You will see something that Adam and Eve did not see, and that is you will see God face to face. You will be in God's immediate presence, whatever that means. We don't know. We don't have any way to explain it. Adam and Eve didn't have that. Adam and Eve interacted with God after a fashion, but God veiled himself from them so that they could be tested, just like he did with the angels. It's interesting that when God created the angels, they were not in the beatific vision. They were in something analogous to like Adam and Eve's Garden of Eden. It wasn't a garden for the angels, but they didn't see God face to face. But once they passed or failed the test, then in the case of those angels who passed their test, they went straight into the beatific vision. They beheld God face to face, and they were confirmed in grace. That's why the good angels can never sin. Not that they don't have free will, they do, but it would be unthinkable to them to turn away from God whom they see face to face. So it was true in Adam and Eve's case as well, where they didn't see God face to face, and therefore they freely sinned. And what makes it even worse, Brody, is that you and I, after the fall, we have all kinds of things that we have to contend with, like concupiscence, the disordered inclination to sin, and unruly passions, and we don't have an integrated intellect and will. Adam and Eve did have all those things, and they still sinned, which made their sin all the more malicious. So it's for that reason that in heaven you won't sin, because you're going to see God face to face.
All right.
Okay.
Well, thank you for your time.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you, Brody. Thanks very, very much. You know what? Let's send Brody a copy of The Truth Is Out There if he'd like it. Brody, if you have the permission from whatever adult is there with you to give your address, just make sure you have permission before you give it out. But if you have permission, give it to Edgar, and we'll send you a book called The Truth Is Out There. It's a what they call a graphic novel, and one I think you'll like very much from Catholic Answers Press. Patrick Madrid is our guest. Patrick, among those who were very first here at Catholic Answers, and not only that, among those who were the very first in the new apologetics movement in the United States, which has flowered and brought so much fruit. I say the United States, but I mean around the world, really. And we're just delighted to have him here in the studio with us. If you've got a question for Patrick, 888-318-7884.
You're listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity in The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church at shop.catholic.com or pick it up at a good Catholic bookstore.
In These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes, bestselling author Rod Bennett gives a riveting reexamination of gospel events from the ground floor perspective of Christ's own handpicked successors. In his trademark storytelling style, Bennett movingly depicts what it was like for the apostles to witness Jesus' teaching and miracles up close. Why did he call them, and what did he intend for them to do? Order your copy of These 12 today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Miss a show? Make sure to catch up by downloading the podcast, available online at Catholic.com.
Hi, this is Jonette Williams. We bring you the truth of the Catholic faith on Women of Grace tomorrow at 11 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Patrick Madrid has been doing this for a long time here as our guest, and I'm not trying to say you're old. That came across as a little bit like maybe a passive-aggressive.
I'm a man of a certain age.
You are a man of a certain age, yes.
I never thought I'd get to this age either.
Do you still have tacos every Tuesday? Is that really a thing, Taco Tuesday with you?
Well, it's become a thing.
Yeah.
I think once I mentioned it on the show, it just got legs and took off and everybody rallied around that. But I do like tacos as much as the next guy.
Yeah. Okay, good. The number, by the way, is 888-318-7884. And it's in addition to having Patrick here, who was one of the, as I was saying earlier, one of the very earliest members of the Catholic Answers family, the second hire here at Catholic Answers. We also, by a strange coincidence, have the first caller to the Catholic Answers radio show here with us today. And that caller is named Patrick Madrid. I just
what
found
a fluke
this out.
This was.
What a weird fluke. Yeah. You were the first caller to the radio program.
Yeah, but not by design. It was so weird because Catholic Answers, what year was it? 98, you say?
98,
okay.
Yeah.
So when the announcement was made, and I had left the apostolate some years before that. So I was really excited that this new thing was happening. And so when they announced the show started at this time, I called the number, and I was just one of who knows how many people waiting to get on the air. And they went to the first caller, and the caller wasn't there. So then the host said, okay, let's go to the next caller, and it just went to me. So I became the first caller in the first hour of the first program ever, and I was so thrilled because it was a great opportunity to congratulate Carl and the team and everybody, but it just was a fluke.
Isn't that funny? Yeah. You're the first caller. And Darren said he heard the recording the other day, he checked to see who the first caller was, but we can't play it because we use electronics recordings now, and that I believe was recorded on a stone tablet.
I think
I'm
you're
fairly
right.
certain
it
that,
was
that was
back in the day.
Yeah, back when our sound engineer was Barney Rubble. Shall we go to Rhode Island? Let's talk to Aaron in Rhode Island, watching on Catholic.com. Aaron, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Patrick Madrid.
Hi, I would just like to start off by saying two things. Thank you for taking my call, and Patrick, thank you for converting me to Catholicism.
Oh, wow.
Praise God. That's wonderful.
Wow, beautiful, Aaron.
What did you convert from, Aaron?
I was non-denominational.
Okay. Do you remember what it was that drew you to the church?
I kept watching videos on Why Be Catholic, and I kept watching videos, and they weren't sufficient, but then I watched your video, and that really locked me in.
Mm. I'm happy to hear that. Welcome home.
Oh, thank you. And so my question for you is, how do I go about converting my friends to Catholicism?
And what are your friends? Are they Protestant folk? Are they atheists, or who are they?
They're all atheists.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, atheists are convertible. I've met a few myself, so they're not certainly not too far away to be converted. I think you have to approach them, of course, with the logical and rational evidence for the existence of God. Obviously, if you're quoting the Bible to an atheist, it doesn't really matter because he doesn't believe in the Bible anyway. So I would advise you to steep yourself in the ways that you can make a rational case for the existence of God. And that would extend from the what are called the five proofs, or the five ways that were really pioneered by Aristotle, but they were refined by St. Thomas Aquinas. If you are familiar with those five, especially, and that would be the argument from motion and change, and how things not only move through space but also move in terms of their change from potency to act. Everything is getting older; things become what they weren't before. All these things are set in motion by something that comes before it. That would be one proof. Another proof would be the argument from efficient causality, in which you go through the logical evidence for things having causes. Nothing comes from nothing, and things don't come into existence out of nothing. They all have an efficient cause. Another argument would be the argument from time and contingency, in which you show that the universe itself and all the things in the universe are contingent, meaning that they are not necessary to be here, and yet they are here. And you can't have an infinite number of unnecessary beings that come into existence because something before it brought it into existence, but something before that brought it into existence. There's no way to have an infinite number of contingent beings unless there's a necessary being who first brought all these other things into existence, either directly or indirectly, that being we call God. There's also the argument from degrees of perfection, in which you can see, as we all do every day, that there are certain standards that we assume that must be there in order for us to make comparisons to things that are lesser in some way. And then lastly, the fifth one would be the argument from design. Now, this is different to some extent from the scientific squabble about intelligent design, but just simply to see that things are designed and things have a goal-orientedness about them. Your eye, for example, your ear. And also in natural law, you can see that certain things are tending toward a kind of goal. And this would require an explanation for how is it that something can have a goal in mind if there's not somebody there who intended the thing to have a goal in the first place. And these are ways of talking about sort of these first causes or first principles that help us to understand how it is rational to believe that God exists. you can talk about things like from the scientific world, like DNA and how DNA is information. It's encoded information that is designed to be intelligible. So within the cell and the cell processes, this DNA, which we didn't even really know existed until within the last, 100 years perhaps, and only even more recently have we developed the ability to understand DNA and to read DNA, and now we realize that DNA is information. So information that is intelligible and readable and replicable cannot come from the chaos of natural forces working blindly in an undirected manner against each other over eons of time. They can't produce information in that way. So if you want to go down the scientific track, there are things that point to the existence of God. But my advice would be, to answer your question, steep yourself in these matters and become proficient in them so that you can, at a moment's notice, you can talk about them in your own way. You don't have to use the fancy terms if you don't want to, but to be able to share these concepts with your atheist friends, and also, lastly, to know how to critique atheism and how to show that the atheist worldview is predicated upon, among other things, maybe most fundamentally, this idea that the only things that really exist are material, that there is no immaterial realm. There's no supernatural realm. There's no heaven or hell. There are no gods or God. There are no souls, no angels or devils. And so start there and point out that if that's true and the only things that exist are material, then how do we account for immaterial realities that we all know exist, things like knowledge and memory and friendship and love and truth itself, which is also immaterial? We all know these things exist. And you can critique atheism on its own merits, and that's another way that you can go about doing this. So if these people that you're talking about are thoroughgoing atheists, these are ways in which you can begin a conversation with them. Edward Fazer is a very excellent author on this. Dr. Peter Kraft and Father Ron Tosselli, excellent books on this topic. And there are many others. So these are books that you could turn to feed your mind to be able to talk about these issues.
Aaron, I'm going to leave it there because the lines continue full, and we don't have Patrick here.
Sorry for that long answer, by the way.
We do want to answer the question, though, and it was a very important one. And Aaron, I thank you. I hope you'll call more, but I got to move on now. I'm going to go to Tampa, Florida now. Andrew, watching on YouTube down in Tampa, Florida. Go ahead with your question, Andrew.
So I was recently watching an Ascension Presents video, and it brought up the question of why did Jesus have to return to heaven? And I feel like I didn't answer the question. I was wondering if you could answer why Jesus didn't remain on earth as opposed to rising to heaven.
Interesting question. I don't know what the video said, so I can't speak to that. But I do know that Jesus himself said, "It is necessary that I go to the Father." Now, interestingly, when he told his apostles this, and he said, "If I do not go, then the Holy Spirit will not come to you, that I will send you to guide you into all truth." So Jesus gave us sort of a tantalizing answer to your question by saying that he must do this, and if he didn't do it, something important wouldn't happen. But he doesn't explain why. So we're left to surmise what those whys might be. And there's some really good things that we can infer from this statement. But ultimately, Jesus himself said that he must do this. So for me personally, I think that this was probably, among other things, twofold. Number one, to show that he is God definitively, not only by the resurrection, but also by his returning to heaven, body and soul, in his human nature as well as his divinity. But also for the inauguration of the church, because the mission of the church was not to rely upon Jesus in being present at a certain place on earth, but the church's mission was to spread the gospel and to be a witness to this, as opposed to having people just show up in Jerusalem to see Jesus. And this is how he established it. So I guess I'll have to leave it at that. I'm afraid of giving a long answer again, but those are some of the things that strike me.
Have you ever heard Tim Staples?
Yes. Maybe that's where I got some of this.
I'm going to leave it there, Andrew, too, because we got to take a quick break. Patrick Madrid is our guest. We couldn't be more delighted about that fact. You're welcome to call and ask your question. It's open forum, 888-318-7884.
Hang on. We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
I am a very happy, grateful revert to the faith. About 12 years ago, I was surfing the channels and I found EWTN. I didn't even know it existed, and I heard Mother and remembered that years ago I had told a Catholic nun at a church in Boston that I was visiting that I missed the faith, and she said, "You will come back." And when I was listening to Mother Angelica, I remembered that.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Here at Catholic Answers, we're trying to send Catholic Answers magazine to as many of our serving members of the armed forces as we can. And we thought a good way to ask you for your help to do that would be on Memorial Day weekend. So until Memorial Day, anybody who donates anything to Catholic Answers, any amount, can just give us a name and address of a currently serving member of the armed forces. And that includes Space Force, and that includes the Coast Guard, and if they're serving in the armed forces, then they can have it. You just got to give us a name and address and a donation in any amount. And the place you can do that is go to givecatholic.com, givecatholic.com, and we'll get as many copies out as you sign them up for. Patrick, apparently we have found the stone tablet that has that recording on it.
Really?
Can we hear Patrick Madrid? The very
You actually have that.
1998.
Awesome.
The very first caller to the Catholic Answers radio program. Here it is.
Well, let's see if we can get the phone situation straightened out here. And let's go to line number one and find out if someone is there with us. Hello? No, we're not getting anything there. Is there another line there, Joe, our producer? Let's go to line three. Hello?
Hello.
Is this Patrick?
Yeah, Jerry. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Carl and James. Congratulations.
Thank you, Patrick. Good to hear from you.
Thanks.
Oh, that's all we got right now. Okay. That's Jerry Escher.
And that's who it is.
And Patrick Madrid. And how long did it take them to figure out that it was you? Did they know right away?
They knew right away. Oh, yeah. But it was not planned. It was purely accidental.
Well, you could hear that first call drop, just like you said.
Yeah.
Jerry Escher, man, made quite a contribution to Catholic media,
yes,
didn't he?
He's
still doing it every day.
Still going strong.
Let's go to Alabama. Mark in Alabama, listening on the Catholic Answers app. Mark, thank you for downloading the app onto your phone. Go ahead with that question for Patrick Madrid.
All right. Appreciate you taking my call. So I have a question about the annulment process. I am divorced and remarried, and I want to join my local Catholic church, but my current wife does not, and we have a hard time understanding why she has to fill out the annulment process application as well. I completely understand why I have to, but why does she?
Well, to be fair, this is a question that a canon lawyer could answer definitively, and I'm not a canon lawyer, so I can only take a guess at this. But I wonder if there is some question about her background. Was she married before she married you, or is this her first marriage with you?
She was married prior to me as well.
I suspect it's probably for that reason, because as part of the church's evaluation of your circumstances when you had your first marriage, in order to determine whether that first marriage was in fact valid or null. Here again, a canon lawyer could probably easily tell you, oh, it's for this and this reason. But I suspect that it's also because there's now going to be a question about her first marriage and whether or not that marriage was null or valid, because that too would enter into it. It might be that your first marriage was not valid, but hers was. So this is where the church needs to find out, so that both of you have the clarity and you can know with certitude whether or not you can continue in this marriage or not. We want to welcome you into the Catholic Church. I'm sure I can speak for all the Catholics at your parish. We want to welcome you, and we do welcome you. And hopefully this process will be as problem-free as possible. But it's an important process because, as you know, Jesus said that if a man divorces his wife and marries another, he commits adultery, except, as he says in Matthew chapter 19, except in the case of porneia, or sexual unlawfulness. And that's really what's at issue here, is to determine whether or not that first marriage, even though all the parties might have been sincere and well-intentioned, if that first marriage was actually invalid, then when that man and woman divorce, they are not committing adultery if they seek to get remarried. They would be eligible to get remarried. But the only way to know for sure is to do the due diligence, which the church does, to determine whether or not that first marriage was null or valid. That's what, as I assume, reading between the lines here, that's why they're asking for this information, so they can help the two of you arrive at that certitude.
And Mark, I'm going to leave it there because there are just so many folks lined up to talk with Patrick Madrid. Going to go to an anonymous caller in West Virginia watching on YouTube. Anonymous, go ahead with your question for Patrick.
Hi, Mr. Madrid. I have some devout Catholic friends who like to gossip, and I myself do not like to gossip, but I also am very passive and I hate confrontation. I'm also very scrupulous and I have a lot of anxiety. And so when they are gossiping to me, I don't tell them to stop, but I'm also not listening with pleasure. And I was wondering if that was a sin not to stop them from their gossip. And if so, I really don't know how I'd be able to continue a relationship with them because I just don't have the strength to call them out.
Okay.
Thank you.
Certainly. Well, especially if you know that you suffer from scrupulosity, that's another reason to be really careful not to assume that because you're not stepping in to stop them from doing something that may be sinful and probably is, that you yourself are committing a sin. My sense would be that you almost certainly are not committing any sin whatsoever. The only way in which it might be a sin would be a sin of omission. If you had some standing or some reason, some responsibility even, that you should say something, like if you were the father of a family and your kids are gossiping, well, you have standing, you have an obligation to form your children. So it would be a sin, or it could be a sin of omission if you refrain from doing your duty. But it doesn't sound to me like you have any duty here. You're not participating in it. You're not enjoying it. You have reasons to be reluctant to say anything about it, and God understands that. So no, nothing that you describe suggests to me that you're committing any kind of a sin.
Does that ease your mind, Anonymous?
Yes, thank you so much.
All right, God bless you, brother. Thank you very much for the call. Hayden, Idaho is next. Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening on the EWTN app. Emma, go ahead with your question for Patrick.
Hi, Si. Hey, Patrick, I called you when I was in Costa Rica. I'd become a new Catholic, and I told you that my knees buckled when I got the host.
I remember that call, yes.
I know.
Welcome home.
Anyway, thank you. Thank you. I feel like I'm home like I've never before in my life. It's been a long journey, but I'm here. So there's a question about whether Judas went to heaven or not. And in the Last Supper, Jesus said that one among you is a devil.
Mm-hmm.
So is that condemning him, or was that just...
He said that specifically at the very end of John chapter 6. So at the end of the Bread of Life discourse, where some of his disciples fell away and they would not believe his teaching on this, he turns to the apostles and says, will you also leave? And Simon Peter says, Lord, to whom should we go? You have the words of eternal life. And it's immediately after that that he says, and did I not choose all of you, and yet one of you is a devil? And it identifies him speaking about Judas. So that's in John chapter 6. But we also know from the Last Supper accounts that the devil fully possessed Judas, at that point. We're told the devil entered into him. So I know there is a kind of... There's an undercurrent, let me put it that way, among some Catholics who really, really, really want to figure out a way to make it so that Judas didn't go to hell. But I don't see how we can make that case, especially since Jesus in John chapter 17 says, Father, all of those that you gave to me, I have saved, I have protected, except one who was lost, the son of perdition, referring to Judas. So he specifically there says that Judas was lost. The others were not lost, but Judas was lost. It's hard for me to reconcile that with the notion that Judas went to heaven. Furthermore, Jesus said that it would have been better for that man to have never been born. So I have a hard time understanding how that could be true if ultimately Judas went to heaven, because the very best thing that could ever happen to you would be to go to heaven. And so it'd be a very good thing if you were born, if you wind up in heaven. So those are some of the scriptural monuments to this issue that I find difficult to reconcile with the view that Judas went to heaven. But in any case, it's not something that we can know with certitude one way or the other. I personally believe that the biblical evidence is really clear that Judas did not go to heaven.
Thanks, Emma. Time getting really short now, yeah. So I'm going to keep moving.
Scott, yeah, let's do it.
Down in Texas, listening on 9:10 a.m., you are up next. Scott, go ahead with your question for Patrick.
Thanks so much. Hi, Mr. Madrid. Listen,
hi, Scott.
I want you to answer my question. Let me put it this way. If I were going to sell my house, I would not bury a statue of St. Joseph upside down in my front yard. I would not do that. Would that be sinful? That's my question for you.
No, it would not be sinful to not. I think so. It would not be sinful to not bury a statue of St. Joseph. I think that that's a form of superstition. And it's different from somebody wearing a miraculous medal or sprinkling holy water in faith. This is a superstition that's often, more often than not, practiced by people who don't even necessarily believe in God or in the intercession of St. Joseph. It's just a superstition. So if you're asking me if it would be sinful not to do it, well, by all means, it's not sinful not to do it. I think it could be sinful to do it if you're doing it for the wrong reasons. My wife and I were trying to sell a house in California for well over a year, and we had no success. And a friend was telling us, bury a statue of St. Joseph, bury it sideways, bury it upside down, bury it in the backyard. And we both said, no, we're not going to do that. So we started a novena to St. Joseph. And on the ninth day of the novena, after having absolutely no interest in this house whatsoever for about a year, on that last day of the novena, we sold a house. So that's my takeaway from that issue.
All right, Scott.
Yeah, that's good. I have one more question, if you don't mind, Mr. Madrid. How do you like being an adjunct at Steubenville University? Is that too personal a question for you? I'm sure you like it very much. Do you like it?
It's not. I did teach there for several semesters in the classroom as an adjunct, and I enjoyed it tremendously. I was grateful for the opportunity. But that's long ago. I now teach I have been for about 10 years now. I teach as an adjunct at St. Patrick Seminary and University in Menlo Park, California, and also at Holy Apostles College and Seminary in Cromwell, Connecticut. But I very much enjoyed teaching.
Scott, thank you very, very much. And thanks for that opportunity to talk about. You know, Patrick, I'm glad to hear you use the word superstition because, we're often accused as Catholics of superstitious practices. Mm-hmm. And there are no Catholic practices that are superstitious, but there are superstitious things that Catholic people do.
That's true.
And we got to talk about that.
Yeah. The St. Joseph statue, I don't mean to offend anybody because I know some people who are really sincere have done this and they'll tell, I sold my house kind of thing. But it doesn't mean it's not superstitious. And for me, the distinction is if somebody is doing something in faith, genuine faith, seeking God's will and using holy water or something like that, that's different. But when somebody says, if I bury this statue and I do it upside down or I do it in this yard, God's going to give me what I want, that's superstition. That's not how it works.
No, right. That's like that's some kind of a spell or something that gives you power that God's got to do what you... Well, I did. I buried St. Joseph upside down. Now he's going to have to sell my house.
Yeah, he has no choice.
I wonder how it ended up upside down, too. I mean, that does seems very disrespectful.
Yeah.
And you have one of the greatest lines ever about... You know that people repeat your line all the time about... Do you know that?
About statues worshiping statues.
Statues worshiping statues, yes. If you don't know it, look it up on the internet. It's probably out there somewhere.
That was Patrick. And it really happened to me. It really did happen.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It is a classic line. What a great pleasure to have you
thank
here,
you,
Patrick.
Si. Yeah, thank you, Si. Great to be with you again.
Thank you very,
thank
very
you.
Much.
And God Nancy, bless Catholic Answers.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. And Relevant Radio. And Nancy, thank you so much for coming in. It's always nice to see Nancy Madrid. And I saw Tim Staples. He's in the building. Whenever that happens, we all breathe a great big sigh of relief. That means he remembered that he's doing the next hour with us. So Tim Staples will be with us next hour, and we'll continue with Open Forum. So if you're on the line, go ahead and stay on the line. If you haven't dialed yet, there's a couple lines open, 888-318-7884. And if you'd like to give a subscription to Catholic Answers Magazine to a service member this weekend, just go to givecatholic.com and a donation in any amount. And then you can just write in the name and address, and we'll send that magazine subscription out to them. Right back with Tim Staples on Catholic Answers Live.